I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast, and I'm taking this time to ask you during the month of December to financially support the Cato Daily Podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute to advance individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and support our efforts. This is the only time of the year when I make this request, so I'm adding something. If you support Cato to the tune of $1,000 or more, I'll gladly give you a shout-out on the podcast, or you can designate another individual to receive the benefits of that donation. Just visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to get started, and thank you. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, December 15th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. When opponents of school choice talk about pending policies, the language is not just heated, it's apocalyptic. And it doesn't really matter how big the choice program in question might be. Jason Bedrick directs policy at EdChoice. His big takeaway is that if people defending the status quo are going to go nuclear no matter what, the clear lesson for lawmakers pondering choice legislation is to go big.
Whenever there is a school choice program that is being offered, there is a, well, I hate to say it, but it's really a predictable response from the groups that are opposed. The differences among the proposals doesn't really seem to have much of an impact on how the traditional institutions respond to the school choice program. It could be a small program, it could be a large program. The responses are largely the same. So to the extent that these people who are defenders of, for lack of a better term, big ed, the education establishment, What do those claims look like?
Well, it's the same thing. It's predictable because we've been hearing the same thing the last 30 years, which is this is going to destroy public education. And so what my colleague, Ed Tarnowski, and I did is we went back and gathered a whole bunch of quotes from folks making these predictions in the five states that have the oldest and largest school choice programs. So that'd be Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Ohio, and Wisconsin. And what you find is a whole bunch of people back in those days saying things like, well, this comes from Florida, then state rep Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who listeners may know. She said, "This is the day that will go down in the annals of Florida history as the day we abandoned the public schools, and the day that we abandon, more importantly, our children." And she said that in Florida on March 25th, 1999. So fast forward more than two decades, and what do we find? Well, we find that in all five of these states with the longstanding robust school choice programs, they have improved on the NAEP. That's the National Assessment for Educational Progress. In most cases, they've actually improved at a faster rate than the national average. So far from the system collapsing, as you can look in the report, we've got, you know, a dozen people making these sorts of predictions in different states. All the evidence that we have shows that school choice actually leads to positive outcomes. As a matter of fact, out of 28 studies, academic studies on the effects of school choice programs on the performance of traditional district schools, all but three of them find a statistically significant positive effect.
I guess what's the point? You pull this information out of these statements over the last few decades about school choice programs or school choice expansions and the responses from the education establishment. What's the point of gathering that and detailing it?
The point is that policymakers shouldn't listen to the Chicken Littles, right? They're going to squawk that the sky is falling no matter what. And without regard to the mountain of evidence we have, that not only does the sky not fall, but it's a clear and sunny day. And these programs not only do not harm the students who are in the traditional system, but actually leads to modest improvement of that system. And actually, one of the more recent studies out of Florida shows that the improvement increases over time, and the improvement increases when they're exposed to more competition, which, I mean, this is what we see in, you know, every other area of human interaction, that when you have a variety of different options, that people can choose from that leads to greater quality over time. The other thing is, as you alluded to at the beginning, in the second part of the report, what we do is we look at five states that passed new programs this past year. And
what states are those?
So West Virginia and New Hampshire had the largest programs. West Virginia has what's called the Hope Scholarship. It's a K-12 education savings account that every single child in the state, if they are switching out of a traditional district school or entering kindergarten, are eligible. So that's 93% of kids in the state are eligible. It's now the largest program in the country. New Hampshire is just about a third of students who are eligible. And in both those states, they are eligible and funded. So if you apply and you're eligible, you get an ESA. And then we look at three other states. That would be Arkansas, Kentucky, and Missouri. Each of these states have new programs, either a tax credit scholarship or a tax credit funded education savings account. But all of them, only about 1% of students in the state are both eligible and funded. As a matter of fact, in Arkansas, it's fewer than 0.1%. And so what we were doing in this case is we were seeing if the level of rhetorical intensity by the opponents of school choice varied based on the size and scope of the proposal. And lo and behold, it does not. We did a scale of 1 to 10, but actually went up to 11 in the spirit of Spinal Tap. We saw that the opponents often went all the way up to 11. 10 is catastrophic. 11 is apocalyptic. These are the folks who are saying, things like, this is the end of public education. Even Governor Beshear in Kentucky, again, fewer than 1% of kids eligible and funded. And he says, this is the beginning of the end of public education. There was somebody in Kentucky who said, once again, public education has its head in the guillotine, getting ready to have its head chopped off. It was about an average of an 8 all across these states. As a matter of fact, Arkansas was the highest rhetorical intensity, even though it had the smallest of the programs.
So the lesson for policymakers, because I know there are policymakers in many of these states who read the papers, who follow important public ed leaders on Twitter. And so to the extent that they're looking at those comments and understanding that the size of the program doesn't necessarily impact the level of the vitriol, what's the clear lesson for them?
Go big or go home. I mean, just no matter what you're going to do, if you're going to put forward a program for every child in the state, or you're going to put forward something that's, for redheaded, left-handed kids from low-income homes, and you can serve 17 kids in the state, no matter what happens, the other side is going to say, this is going to be the end of public education. Don't expect that if you moderate the ambitiousness of the school choice policy that you're putting forward, the other side is going to correspondingly moderate their rhetoric. They are not. They're going to come at you with everything they've got. You may as well be going for gold, which is making sure that every single child has access to the learning environment that works best for him or her.
Jason Bedrick is an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and director of policy at EdChoice. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.